is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, I am Micah Hanks. And this, my friends, is the Grillion Report, as you know. But in case you don't, I'm here to tell you. In fact, I'm here to tell you all the news that's fit for print or for the web, or at least for echoing off the hallowed halls of the Mohorovic Discontinuity, where we broadcast to you every Tuesday night from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you for joining us for yet another week of the weird. And let me tell you, we've got a good one lined up for you. But, you know, our Sunday program suffered only slightly because my favorite guy, Caleb, was not here. He's back in the bunker, back from vacation, back from performing with his ska group, Crazy Tom Banana Pants. They were performing. What was the name of the band that was playing with you guys, Caleb?
Demon Waffle.
Yeah, Demon Waffle. You know, it sounded like a breakfast buffet up there on stage the other night, but I hope the show went well.
It went well. There was lots of potassium.
I think there's always lots of potassium where Caleb is. Tyler Pittman, the producer of the program, also in studio with us. Tyler, welcome. Thank you for being here.
As always, Micah.
It's always my pleasure to have you. And, of course, you've got the Grillion Gang, all of us here in the bunker. To all of you out there in Gradio Land, welcome to another week in the Weird. On tonight's program, we'll be joined shortly by our friends at Grimerica. They put out a fantastic podcast. Caleb and I have known Darren and Graham through this program for a long time, but they made it out to Paradigm Symposium last year, where we finally got to meet them in person and subsequently began their own podcast, Grimerica. And so it's featured guests the likes of, well, you know, Caleb and I have both been on the program, as well as Red Pill Junkie. They've had all kinds of other people. I believe Dennis McKenna's even been on their program, which is, you know, one hell of a good guest. And we're going to have them as guests on our program tonight to sort of simulcast with our friends up there in, well, if we're in the bunker, they're in the igloo. They're way up north. So we'll be having the guys joining us direct via the World Wide Web from the igloo up north.
It's the one place where you can get Darren Grimes to tell you where, well,
you want to know how I got these scars.
That's He's right. The Canadian Joker.
He is the... Speaking of Jokers, or Zokars, as a matter of fact, you know, all I've seen in the news today, guys, is the conspiracy element that's been brought to the forefront. Wall Street Journal, USA Today, they're just among a few of the news sources that have been carrying the conspiratorial allegations regarding the Tsarnaev brothers. These are the two boys who were... Well, they weren't boys. They were grown men. They weren't very old, but they nonetheless were found to be the alleged bombers in this Boston Marathon bombing. I say alleged because they have not actually been found guilty of the crime yet, but they are the accused bombers. Tamerlan Tsarnaev, apparently, this is the first big story that came out today. WSJ carried it, and they said that Tsarnaev was into conspiracy theories and even read, apparently, an Alabama-produced newspaper that may have dealt with some of these subjects. It's interesting. They report that he was exposed to a wide range of conspiracy theories, along with radical Islamist teachings, according to this report that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. Publications espousing conspiracy theories, including what some have described as an Alabama-based white supremacist newspaper, were found in the elder brother's apartment. Now, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who was killed in the firefight with police on April 19th during a manhunt following the Boston Marathon bombings, was exposed to many of the radical theories via a 67-year-old man named Donald Larkin. Now, this is where the story begins to get fairly interesting. I have to say that among the interesting conspiracy angled stories that have been reported in the last few hours, this story, USA Today, elaborated on this a bit. There was apparently a mentally challenged man. He had suffered a gunshot wound to the hand, while he had been working as a gas station attendant many years ago.
And pardon me, is that what it said? Because I was under the impression they were trying to paint him as the guy who had robbed the gas station.
It says here, attorney Jason Rosenberg, who represents the family of Donald Larkin, said that Larkin shared publications with the Tsarnaev brothers, especially Tamerlan, and discussed theories including the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks and the Newtown, Connecticut elementary school shooting didn't happen, or that the U.S. government had been behind them. They were false flags. But now what it says here is that the attorney had said the Tsarnaev family had a relationship with the Larkins, he and his wife. And let's see, I want to find the relevant portion here. Rosenberg had actually told the press just today that Larkin, now get this, he did not live in Newtown, Connecticut. He lived in West Newton, which, as I understand, is just outside Boston. okay, close enough for him to have this relationship with the Sarnaev brothers. It says that he was shot in the head in 1974 in an attempted robbery while working in a convenience store. He said Larkin suffered brain damage as a result of this, and this had led to problems with his decision-making and judgment. Now, authorities are saying that the Sarnaev brothers orchestrated the April 15th marathon bombing. Of course, we all know the story. It's familiar to most of us. It involved two pressure cookers loaded with shrapnel, and I think they'd put metal ball bearings and things like that in there. Zokhar Sarnaev pleaded not guilty last month. Nonetheless, the charges against him were, of course, well, you know, attempted murder and using a weapon of mass destruction to kill. Now, Tamerlan died after the shootout with police a few days after the bombing. The photos of the younger Sarnaev brother, Zokhar, actually submitting and turning himself into the police were released. The officer who released those from, I believe, the Boston Police Department was excused from active duty or something to that effect while an investigation ensues. In other words, they didn't want those photos released, and he released the photos in response to Rolling Stone, of course, putting this, what you might call a glamour shot, almost, of Zokhar Sarnaev on the cover of their magazine. A lot of places, including, I believe, CVS pharmacies, had literally said they were going to boycott the magazine, that they weren't going to carry the magazine after displaying this issue, or rather this photograph. And furthermore, that in the magazine, it allegedly referred to Zokhar Sarnaev as the bomber, when in fact, again, he is the accused bomber. He has not been found guilty of the crime yet. So, anyway, it's a complex situation, but I was just amazed today at how many news stories and how many news agencies were carrying the story that the Sarnaev brothers were exposed to conspiracy theories, which, you know, I mean, I don't think that that's not the case here. I think that is quite clearly the case. But what's interesting is that this, of course, is now what the media is portraying as a dangerous element within our society. In other words, yes, these two men were radicalized extremists, but because perhaps of their exposure to things such as conspiracy theories, perhaps these young men, impressionable young men, were misguided on part of the influence. The
this
exposure.
Particular Mel Gibson movie will melt your mind and turn you into a terrorist.
Yeah, and I was looking through the news today. I mean, literally 22 hours ago, The Guardian carried this story beyond the conspiracy theory that surrounds the Illuminati. Tyler and I were looking at this before Caleb came into the studio. I think he was down in what we call a Studio D down the hall there a little ways. But get this, there's 14 hours ago, Mother Jones carried the seven craziest Obamacare conspiracies. 4 days ago, handtime.blogs.nba.com, conspiracy theories follow Nets. This is a basketball-oriented conspiracy. Folks, if you don't think we're living in a conspiracy culture, 2 days ago, get this one. Here was a Palestine-oriented website, the deadliest Israel lobby conspiracy theories. Dreadcentral.com, 8 hours ago, carried this story, the conspiracy. Exclusive Q&A with director Christopher McBride. Hacker's mysterious death prompts conspiracy theories and concerns about pacemakers, according to ABC News just yesterday. So tell me that conspiracy theories aren't on people's minds. But again, the way that the media is portraying this story today, the message I'm getting, tell me if I'm wrong, maybe I'm the odd man out here, but the message I'm getting from all this is that yes, the media seems to want you to think that if you read conspiracy theories, you are subjecting your mind to garbage and trash that could corrupt you and literally cause you to go out there and do unsavory things, maybe the likes of which the Sarnaev brothers did. Now, frankly, I'm sorry, I don't think someone that tunes into a program like this one, or Alex Jones, who reads Drudge Report or Infowars.com, I say Drudge Report because they carry a lot of conspiracy-oriented stories there too. Matt Drudge certainly does. You know, if you read these kind of, hell, if you read the news anywhere, you're going to read about conspiracy theories, as I just showed you. I don't think that just reading conspiracy theories and news oriented around conspiracy theories is necessarily going to corrupt America and cause people to go out there and do dreadful things. But that seems to be the underlying message that the media is portraying here, at least as I'm reading it. I don't know if you disagree. What are your thoughts? You can tune into the program. You can actually reach out to us and interact with us if you'd like to just as well. There are a number of ways to do it. 828-398-4886 will get you to the bunker live and direct. You can text us anytime, 828-367-7201. And of course, folks always love to email us, and you can always do that, info@graylianreport.com. You can reach Caleb and Tyler as well. And if you'd like to send a message to one of our producers, Caleb@graylianreport or Tyler@graylianreport.com will reach either of them directly just as well. Now, during hour two, after we finish talking with Grimerica and getting through some of the news, I do want to point out that we're going to be talking, speaking of conspiracies, we are going to be talking about maybe one of my favorite conspiracy theories. And this involves what is known as Majestic 12. Now, most people in the UFO community tend to think that Majestic 12 was a big hoax. We were just talking about this, the guys and I, and I think that the number one reason people think it's a hoax is because, well, first of all, a lot of the allegations that are made in the documents, they were released in 1987 to a researcher by the name of William Moore. A lot of the allegations made in the documents seem a little questionable. These documents allegedly date back to 1950. And furthermore, researchers like Robert Hastings, author of UFOs and Nukes, claim that they have managed to, and this actually took place decades ago, but they had managed to confirm that a typewriter that had been used to create the documents could have been owned by none other than Richard Doty. Folks, you remember the guy that we had on the program a little while ago, Len Kasten? He was supporting a book, a fabulous new book called Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. Caleb has two copies he keeps under his pillow when he goes to sleep at night.
It's for the support for my neck.
That's right. Yeah, helps keep that crick out of your neck in the daytime. Well, anyway, I asked Len Kasten, who mentioned Richard Doty in his book, if you knew anything about this guy. Richard Doty is not only a guy who allegedly dangled a carrot, as Jacques Vallée put it, in front of Linda Moulton Howe, but he also was supposedly the very individual who supplied what are believed to be bogus documents to UFO researchers, the likes of William Moore back in 1987. But it gets a lot stranger than that. And a lot of people, including Robert Hastings, a researcher who I think is bar none one of the best out there in terms of ufology, a lot of them maintain that it's all disinformation and secrecy, but maybe there is... That's not entirely impossible. In fact, I think it's proven that a lot of the MJ-12 documents are probably nothing more than conspiracy and misinformation. But I think that, as is usually the case, there is a grain of truth to this story. And so rather than just going hardline one or the other, yes, there was MJ-12. This was a panel of 12 individuals that included Albert Einstein, that included Robert Oppenheimer, that was headed by Vannevar Bush, and that Dwight Eisenhower and FDR and all these different political figures back in the day that they knew about. Rather than endorsing it entirely or going to the opposite extreme and saying misinformation, disinformation, and null, not good information, just not of use to us at all. I'm not going to go to either extreme. I'm going to say maybe in the middle. Notice this is always the approach I tend to take on this program. Somewhere in the middle, for God's sake, there might be a grain of truth. We're going to look for that grain of truth tonight on the program. And when we come back from this break, we're going to get right to the emails, because I'm going to tell you right now, I get a lot of listener emails for this program, and damned if I'm not hard-pressed to be able to get to them on a weekly basis. We've got some good ones this week, because we love hearing from folks like you out there in Gradioland. It is the Graylian Report, and I am Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, joined by the Graylian Gang, Caleb and Tyler, keeping you company every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. I'm going to try and keep my lips moving in the proper fashion, and we'll be back with you right after this. Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com, and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Bear & Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
We'll be right back.
from the dark heart of the Moho, broadcasting live to the four corners of the globe on the Graylian Net. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and you've locked into your weekly one-stop shop, unless you're tuning in Sunday nights as well to hear us live on the KGRA Radio Network for the Micah Hanks program. Either way, you're going to get the mouth of the South, and glad to be your host for another evening of the odd and unusual. Well, we've got a lot of it for you this evening, but for right now, we want to get to a few listener emails. Maeve writes, "Hey, I was reading the story that you linked in the Graylian Daily News recently about Japanese parapsychology when I got to the part about the Manhattan Project at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Now, I've grown up between Waynesville, North Carolina, and Knoxville, and have been in this area my entire life. We lived in Oak Ridge when I was a baby, and my parents still remember when the alarms would go off and the gates around the town would close long before I was born. Now, I can't help but wonder if some of the strange things that are seen in the sky and in the mountains may have something to do with Oak Ridge. Have you ever looked into the Manhattan Project and the subsequent projects afterward? I know that some of the buildings are still working near Oak Ridge, and that's now the home of the Titan Company, but it would be interesting to learn more about it given its close proximity. Any information or reading suggestions would be greatly appreciated. Keep up the great work, Maeve." Well, I'll put this one out to you. The Manhattan Project, of course, was, during the Second World War, the official project that the U.S. government was carrying out to develop atomic weaponry. And, of course, Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer, was involved directly with that. Now, that was one of the gentlemen who, of course, had said a number of strange things. One quote I've often seen attributed to him that I've tried to get to and substantiate was that allegedly when he was giving, I think it was given a talk either in Rochester or at New York University, a student allegedly asked him if the explosion that occurred, the first detonation of an atomic bomb at Alamogordo, prior to the weapons that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that ended the Pacific Theater during the Second World War, Oppenheimer was asked if that was the first time that a bomb ever was detonated, an atomic bomb on planet Earth. And Oppenheimer's response was apparently this: well, yes, in modern times. Now, many have taken that to mean that he was asserting that there could have been atomic weaponry used in ancient times, but where would he have gotten that idea? It is also known that Oppenheimer often would give as a gift to people copies of the Bhagavad Gita, the ancient Hindu epic, and he even kept a copy at his desk. And there's a famous bit that you can find on the web, on YouTube, where Robert Oppenheimer can be seen being asked about what he called Trinity, the blast that took place there at Alamogordo, and he is sitting there tearfully. He actually reaches up and wipes away a tear as he's talking at one point, but he says as he watched the explosion out over the desert that the words from the Bhagavad Gita came to him: "Now I am become death, destroyer of worlds." And so I've always wondered about Oppenheimer's connection with the possibility that there were ancient technologies here on planet Earth, and whether or not, if you can substantiate that or not is not the question. What I'm interested in is whether or not Oppenheimer had been interested or even believed in the idea of ancient nuclear weapons, and if this even could have spurred his interest in the development of the atomic weaponry that we know to exist today. When we get into our discussion about MJ-12 during Hour 2, you're going to find that, again, Robert Oppenheimer's name comes up once or twice because he, according to some sources, was believed to have been on the 12-person panel that comprised the mythic MJ-12. And I say mythic because, in large part, I think that it is probably more a mythos surrounding bad information that was released to ufologists rather than good information that has been spread around to bad avenues. I really think that probably the majority of it is a myth and, even worse, a hoax. But again, there's often a little truth to every lie. We're going to look at that during Hour 2. Aaron writes, "Man, I've been listening for years, and I always thought the intro to the program was pretty rocking, but then I heard this latest podcast, and a new track with vocals was playing, and it kicked ass. Now, where can I learn more? I've been a guitar player for 30 years, and I really liked that sound. Where do I get more rocking stuff?" The song that you heard, Aaron, is a tune by none other than Rat Jackson. Our good friend Will Arledge is the singer in that band. Kurt Arledge, the drummer. They're fantastic musicians. And I believe, Caleb, is there information online where they can find more about Rat Jackson?
Most likely. I don't know if that band is still really doing much, but the recordings are on iTunes.
Okay, well, look on iTunes, and you'll be able to find on iTunes Rat Jackson. We enjoy their music, too, and that's why you hear it here on the Graylian Report. Now, one of my favorite emails this week, actually, I'm going to get back around to that one here in just a moment because I think we'll save the best for last. But Adam writes, "Micah, first off, let me say, after having found the Graylian Report 2 weeks ago, I've been inhaling the episodes available on iTunes. So thank you and to your team for making the Graylian Report what it is. I'd like to share my experience with owls that I had within hours of listening to your last episode." Of course, he's referencing Mike Cleland coming on and talking about owls, UFOs, and synchronicities. Adam says, "I'd been rolling the idea around in my mind after finishing the episode where David Lynch was expressing, you know, essentially the same sort of thing with owls on the old program Twin Peaks. Now, about an hour later, I was driving to my dentist for my second visit this week for a deep cleaning, and I became hyper aware that affixed to my car's dashboard, there's a small golden owl figurine. I'd purchased it many years ago at the Japan Pavilion at Epcot Center to use as a visualization tool for wealth after reading the book The Secret. Now, I continued to think in passing about the significance of the charm makers choosing the owl form. I then started to think about how I wanted to experience what your guest had experienced with his owl. But my brain got the better of me and reminded me I live in the city and owls, of course, are rarely seen here. Well, I arrived to my appointment and I sat in the dental chair, and then I looked up and there on the wall was a picture with an owl flying tacked to the wall just in front of me. It hadn't been there 4 days earlier. This was something new. Well, as you can imagine, my heart jumped a little. Then I looked over and I saw a book with the same picture propped up on the counter. Well, come to find out, it was a children's book that had been written by a relative of my dental technician, and they had just placed them there in the office since my last visit to help promote it. This certainly reaffirmed to me the power of thoughts on our physical experiences and has really had my mind chewing on the idea that owl synchronicities may indeed represent a different meaning than other symbols. Again, thank you for all you do and the Graylian team. And I wish you guys continued success. Well, you too, Adam. And I'll tell you this. Shortly after, you got to keep in mind, the session we did with Mike Cleland was recorded a while back here in the bunker. He visited Asheville. And then we finally, after we got a number of guest obligations that we had, we got him on the program and did the two-part series. But let me tell you this. This is the rest of the story that you don't know. Now, after Mike came and visited us at the bunker, I was driving home late one evening. In fact, I'd gone to the movies by myself just on a lark to go and see The Great Gatsby with Leonardo DiCaprio.
You went with Leo to the movie? That's spectacular.
I went to see Leo Caprio. I went with Leo Sprinkle, and we were abducted. No, I'm kidding.
Whoa!
I went to the movies to see The Great Gatsby, and when I got out of the movies, I was a bit bittersweet. I mean, if anyone who's seen the movie, or for that matter, who's read the book, and of course, I'm a fan of...
If I had to watch Tobey Maguire act for that long, I'd feel bittersweet, too.
You know, the great thing about Mary Jane...
is that I hunch.
You shouldn't. But anyway, I'm coming home from the theaters, and as I'm driving along, I get out into the country, headed out toward my house, and there's a steep hill you have to drive up before you get out into my neck of the woods, and I'm driving along, and all of a sudden, seriously, the biggest owl I'd ever seen goes flying across the road in front of me. Okay, it's huge. I'm looking at this thing, and it was flying so strangely and so slowly, it almost was like it was in slow motion. And as I'm driving along, I'm watching this thing coast from my line of sight as far to the right as I can see, all the way to the left, and it disappears into the darkness. And I'm just thinking, wow, how strange. Now, I had a friend of mine on the telephone, and as I'm as I'm driving along and I watch this owl move out of my line of sight, suddenly there's this sharp pain between my neck and my right shoulder, this stinging pain. I mean, noticeably so. And then I feel this shrill little kind of trembling that goes all the way up my neck and up toward my right ear. And it continues to tingle until I get all the way up past the top of the hill and I crest and I get all the way down to the road that I have to turn left onto to be able to get back into my neighborhood. And my friend on the telephone with me says, yeah, you know what? We definitely, or rather, she was talking to me, and she said, you know, you definitely sound like you're disturbed. Is everything okay? And I remember I was kidding around, but I said to her, I said, yeah, I think I was just abducted by aliens. I don't think that's what happened, but it was definitely a strange experience involving an owl. And that was, I don't remember correctly, that may have been the same day that Mike Cleland had come to visit. So it was a very odd experience, and there's my owl story. Who knows? Have you ever had an owl story? You out there. If you'd like to share that with us, we'd love to hear from you. info@Graylian Report. Maybe your story will be read on a future edition of the program. Gary writes, gents, I'm a podcast listener, and regarding UAVs in your area that you talked about on your last program, I think that this is, well, less likely other than quadcopters and such, and here's why. There are two ways to fly UAVs in the United States, well, at least routinely. Now, a bit of background for those of you who are just tuning in. Last week on the program, we talked a good bit, Caleb and Tyler and I, about our interest in what appear to be sightings of drones or other small aircraft that are almost silent and that are capable of traveling at relatively slow speeds through the sky that we've been seeing and that others have been seeing around Asheville. Well, Gary has written, and he shares a lot of really useful information. He says, the closest I've found to your location in terms of basically UAV, that's unmanned aerial vehicle, fly zones, is R-3004, which is at Fort Gordon, Georgia. Now, the other is a post at a NOTAM. I'll have to get a designation on what that acronym actually means, regarding where UAVs will be flying. For safety reasons, in other words, you just can't fly a UAV anywhere because these birds, well, they tend to become lawn darts, as he says. Now, for your area, he says KAVL, which I can only imagine is some sort of a landing strip near Asheville, and perhaps even Asheville Regional, is the closest airport. Do a radio search around KAVL. Look for unmanned in the text. For example, search around Palmdale. There's much UAV activity in that area. You'll also see Palmdale airspace. I think they refer to that airport as ZLA. And you can find all kinds of evidence of unmanned craft in that area. That means that there is no UAV activity right at the airport, but in the ZLA airspace around, there is, which is listed further down the page. Now, he goes on to note that there are similar activity that can be found at George Air Force Base, now Southern California Logistics. This is an Air Reserve unit that flies Predator drones in their airspace, and also General Atomics, which flies drones at least in two facilities out in the desert. General Atomics flies them very low and for some reason doesn't need an NOTAM. I imagine the listeners can look all this information up just as well. Creech Air Force Base also flies Predators and Raptors, and Fort Irwin for target practice and green flag exercises. I'm not sure how they travel between these areas, however, because they don't have the apparent NOTAM or SUA. Another acronym I'll have to follow up on. But lastly, what many people think are UAVs are what are known as Burt Rutan's Long EZ and similar aircraft, which we did take a look at here in the bunker, and they do look at least similar to some of the aircraft I think that have been reported around Asheville. They're small, they're fairly formidable little aircraft, and they don't utilize a lot of fuel for traveling long distances, but of course they're also probably very quiet as a result. Kind of a mix between a large glider and a small airplane, and no doubt, I'm sure a few people have seen these things and thought maybe, just maybe we're seeing a UAV. And finally, Mark writes, hello, Mike and the folks at the Gray Alien Report. I hope all is well. I'm writing to tell you about two aerial sightings that I have had, and I witnessed this just since July 22nd. Now, both sightings occurred in the same location, and both were seen by me and a friend. We live on the Canadian-U.S. border at Sault Ste. Marie. The international boundary is marked by the St. Mary's River, which flows out of Lake Superior. On the Michigan side, there is a military base near the shipping canal. Now, on July 22, 2013, my friend and I were walking by the river. The sky was overcast with low, heavy clouds, and just before sunset, shortly after 9 p.m., the sun sets late in the north, we saw a bright white light flying northeast from Michigan across the river into Canada. Now, it moved in a slow arc just under the clouds. The cloud cover was slightly illuminated by the object, and as it approached, the light turned blue. When the object was overhead, we could no longer see the light, but saw instead an oval shape, almost like a beehive. It was dark, black or possibly blue, and looked kind of metallic. It appeared to be segmented by horizontal bands. The bottom of and the top of the object were rounded. There was no light on the underside or on the back of the object, and there were no wings. No propeller could be seen. It sped up several times, accelerating in what appeared to be bursts. It appeared to be hanging in the sky, just gliding along. There was no sound. The object continued into the northeast and eventually disappeared into the clouds. Now, on October 4th, while walking in the same area, folks, this is just days ago, we saw a bright white light, larger and brighter than a planet. It seemed to have the same trajectory and the same arc as the beehive object we had seen a few nights before. It was too dark at this time. It was approximately 10:30 p.m. to see an object, but the light remained visible as it passed into the distance. There was no flashing taillight. There was no sound. The sky was clear that night, and so I can't say how high the object was flying as we'd been able to determine during the last sighting. The light moved with the same fluidity, however, as the previous object, and I did manage a cell phone photo of the light, but the photo, as my wife says, is just unconvincing. Let me just say, I mean, I've even tried to photograph airplanes at night before using my iPhone, and yeah, I know how difficult that can be. Mark continues, I checked the International Space Station schedule, and no, it couldn't have been the station. The light was also too bright and too close to appear like a satellite. Now, if these objects are drones, they're moving across international borders, which, as our previous email from Gary might indicate, that seems highly unlikely. Many years ago, while living in Vancouver, British Columbia, I saw some strange lights. It has been years since I've seen anything unusual like this in the sky, and I find it very odd, maybe even a little disturbing, that the same friend and I have seen two weird aerial phenomena at the same location, and all of it's occurred just within the last 2 weeks. That is indeed very strange, isn't it? who knows exactly what's going on there. Thank you for reading, he says, and thank you for the program. Please continue to do the good work. You know, Mark, we'll do our best, and of course, it always makes our job a little easier when we hear fine stories like that from the likes of you. So thank you for sharing with us, and I'll tell you, you know, it's stories like that that keep me interested and keep me going. And I think what's so fascinating about all this is that there are so many people out there who do exactly what I've done. I started off going, you know, okay, I'm interested in these reports of UFOs and what may be or may not be going on out there. And so I think I'm going to get more involved. And I so often find that people who have listened to this program do the same thing. Maybe this was an introduction. It began as entertainment, and then they have an experience like what Mark had, where they experienced something strange, a beehive-shaped object out there in the sky someplace. And after this experience, this gateway experience, if you will, then people are drawn in, and they want to get into it just as well. And, you know, I know that something very similar probably was the case with my good friends Darren and Graham. For those who listen to this program, you probably already have heard of the Grimerica gang, the Grimerica podcast, and it's a fantastic podcast that Darren Grimes and his associate Graham, who is an enlightened and spiritual type, you know, I was hanging out with him a good bit at the International UFO Congress. I hope he doesn't mind me saying that, but we'll get to that in a moment because we're going to be having them join us here on the program momentarily. They're doing a fantastic podcast called Grimerica, and so Graham Dunlop and Darren Grimes, welcome to the program. It is the Graylian Report, and for the first time, we've got the Grimerica gang live from the Igloo joining us. How are you guys doing tonight?
Not too bad, Micah. Thanks for having us.
Well, it is my pleasure to have you both here. Graham, you're up there, aren't you?
You bet.
There he is. I was hoping. Yeah, you know, what's beautiful about, again, modern technology is it sounds like we're all sitting together in a studio. You guys do a fantastic podcast. We've been enjoying it. I even heard that a popular and very, very controversial podcaster by the name of Adam Curry had mentioned you on his show recently just as well. So you guys have been getting a lot of good press. It's truly our pleasure to have you here on the Graylian Report with us. What's going on in the Igloo tonight?
Not too much. Just sitting down with a glass of whiskey here and treating it like I would one of our shows.
That's the best way to be, isn't it? You know, just sit back, kick back and relax. That's part of my thing, too, is I knew if I've got the guys from Grimerica on the show tonight, we're all going to be having a good time. It might as well be a party in the bunker. And at some point, I hope to get both you guys down here to the bunker just as well. But, you know, you've been making some serious headway with the podcast. Who's going to be your guest this week?
We've got Matt Staggs of disinfo.com and disinfocast, and I think he works for the Joe Rogan Experience as well. He's going to be coming on, we'll record the interview on Wednesday. Usually we release a few days later.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. You know, Matt Staggs is a very interesting guy, and yes, indeed, he is involved with Joe Rogan. You know, what do you guys think about Joe Rogan on his program, basically going after UFOs and saying that we need more evidence?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the show, but the podcast I do like quite a bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I guess Joe Rogan's kind of got his own thing. You must admit he's bringing a lot of attention to some fields.
Yeah, I think it's always good when you get someone out there who draws attention to the kind of work that we do, but also who has the kind of mainstream appeal that Joe Rogan has. And by the way, how rude of me, Darren and Graham, because you guys know Caleb, but you have never been officially introduced to Tyler Pittman. So I just want to take a moment to say Tyler Pittman, Darren and Graham, Tyler Pittman.
Hey, nice Tyler.
To,
big
nice
fan.
To meet you. Oh, well, appreciate it. Likewise, actually.
You guys will be seeing him at Paradigm Symposium, no doubt, just as well.
And a hearty ITM.
Yes, indeed. Now, Graham, you and I actually have an interesting synchronicity that I think is worth sharing just as well. So before we get too far off topic, I'd just been mentioning an owl story that I'd had in relation to Mike Cleland. And it's funny because just today, I hope you don't mind me sharing this, but, you know, as I had been seeing Mike Cleland off at the International UFO Congress, which, again, I alleged that I was probably the last person who had seen him before he had what he believed was some sort of a strange encounter, you had actually driven by and you had been the last person that saw Mike and I together at the International UFO Congress.
Yes. I drove around and then I parked the car and I was leaving. Actually, at that time, I was driving to the airport and I saw you two guys on the curb and I was having a bit of a sad moment, like leaving everybody actually.
Me too.
I got to get a little sappy here, but I was by myself and I'm ready to go to the airport and I was thinking, I just got to say goodbye to these guys again. So I kind of drove around trying to catch up to you guys and I actually couldn't catch you. I couldn't find you.
But I pointed at you, I believe, if I remember correctly. I think I saw you, or maybe that was the first time that you drove around, but I remember I pointed at you, and you brought that up in the email, too. I just thought, how funny, though, that that had been your gut reaction. You know, you, again, coming across to me as being a fairly intuitive person, Graham, and here you may have been the last person that saw me talking to Mike before Mike claims that he went out in the desert and had an abduction experience.
Yeah, that's crazy. Or maybe it started right there in the parking lot, and that's why I couldn't find you guys.
Actually, Graham, the reason that you couldn't find Micah is because a giant owl swooped out of the sky and picked him and Mike up and carried them off into the Arizona desert.
Yeah, you know about Mothman. It was the owl man that got me, guys. Yeah, I succumbed to the great bird of the Arizona skies. So
I have a cool idea for you, Darren and Graham. Since I haven't talked to you since I was on your podcast talking about Gray Street, I was thinking, like, the X-Men had the Canadian Force Alpha Flight. How about you guys be the Alpha Flight of Gray Street?
Oh, we'd be honored, Caleb, of course.
Caleb, they need to be characters on the
Yeah, we're going to put them in the igloo, obviously.
In the igloo, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like if things get, like, yeah, we got the X-Men down here in the U.S., but then if things just, you know, if the fecal matter really hits the spinning turbine, we have to refer this one to the guys at the igloo, so.
Yeah, maybe we could be the Zed men.
Yes, that's it. I think it'd be awesome. It'd be so much fun. You know, I'll tell you, speaking of fun, of course, Darren and Graham, both of you, I'd corresponded with you guys for a long time prior to Paradigm Symposium last year, but that's where we all met. And it was just an amazing, almost instantaneous camaraderie that we all kind of struck up. And so it's just so damn cool to me that you guys have gotten into podcasting. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this is your first live broadcast, isn't it?
Yeah, this would be our first live broadcast. Yeah, Paradigm kind of set the path in the way we got to sit around and hang out with people and pick their brains. And we thought, wouldn't it be cool if we could just do that all the time? But no one would just let us call them up and regale them for an hour.
Well, I would have let you do it. Yeah, I mean, you can call me.
But the podcast seems to make us legitimate, so people are willing to give us an hour or two of their time and let us just go kind of buck wild.
Geez, we're live? Now I'm all nervous.
Oh, no, you didn't know that? Yeah, we're live on the air right now. But you guys, you know, you sound as good as you always do. And I tell you, the podcast sounds fantastic. Now, you know, something else that I want to bring up here is also, correct me if I'm wrong, did you guys not have Dennis McKenna on the program?
Yeah, we had him on about 3 weeks ago, maybe.
Yeah.
And he's quickly becoming our most popular episode.
Well, I can see why. Dennis McKenna, he is just a legend of the field. Of course, for those listening, that is the brother of the late Terrence McKenna, who, of course, you know, I quoted a good bit in my book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule. I've always been fascinated by people like Terrence. That's if Darren and Terrence come together, yeah.
That's if they run together like the two little stations and turn into one big station from Bill and Ted.
Oh, Jesus.
That's what we need. That's right. No, not Jesus. We're close. Pretty close, but...
Jeebus.
This is no time for prayer, Darren.
Yeah. Well, Dennis McKenna is someone I've always wanted to talk to. And again, that just, when you have a guest like that on your program, it sets a pretty high bar. But you guys have been doing really well with it. Again, no agenda. Had even mentioned you guys and referred to you as a damn fine podcast, I believe. So you seem to be doing really well. So what else is going on with the show?
Not too much. We're kind of always learning new things. I think we've finally figured out most of the recording and gremlins like that. For some reason, we always seem to have problems when we've got Red Pill Junkie on. I don't know if it's some sort of Mexican MIBs or what, but...
Yeah, he is definitely the Latin American MIB, except instead of a black suit and a hat and sunglasses, he wears the red luchador mask. Yeah. So, you know, we need to get you guys luchador masks. I think that would solve all the bad luck. You'd scare away the gremlins if you guys wore purple and blue luchador masks when you do your show.
I mean, if we're really trying to hit on the stereotype, since, you know, RPJ is in Mexico and he wears the luchador masks, should the guys in the igloo wear hockey masks?
Yeah, you guys should wear.
Yeah, or maybe balaclavas.
Yeah. Well, I just saw Devo's actually producing a Devo luchador mask, so maybe that's an option.
I don't know. I really love the hockey mask idea, though. You guys can just look like Jason Voorhees up there, you know.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Then everyone would say,
"We'll rock Paradigm this year."
Yeah. Well, no, Darren and Graham, and of course, all of our listeners out there who are planning on attending Paradigm, you'll know Darren and Graham because you'll see the guys in the hockey masks come waltzing, and they'll be wearing, like, it's kind of like the, you know, the Anonymous look when they show up. They wear, you know, three-piece suits and then the Guy Fawkes masks. Well, Darren and Graham will be in three-piece suits and hockey masks at Paradigm Symposium. If you guys keep doing so well, I'm going to have to give you guys a speaking spot up there, okay?
Oh, I don't think we're ready for that yet. Not this year.
Oh, well, maybe next year. You know, guys, we opened the show tonight talking about the conspiracy mentality. I mean, I swear, I think it's permeated the media to this, to the point where, I mean, I'm looking at, like, the news stories today. Everything is a conspiracy now. I mean, I'm seeing literally everything. I read, like, about 8 news headlines that have appeared probably just in the last 24 hours. The deadliest Israel lobby conspiracy theories. The Tsarnaev boys were infiltrated by the thoughts of a conspiracy theorist who had brain damage. You know, all this sort of stuff. I mean, it's everywhere. What do you guys think about conspiracy theories? And what is it about conspiracy theories that is so appealing to people today?
Well, actually, the Grimerica show is a conspiracy.
I've known that since day one. In fact, I'm going to take it all the way back to day zero. I've known since before you guys did your show that it was a conspiracy, but not of silence. It was a conspiracy of cosmic love.
I think it's more prevalent now because people just they can't trust the government anymore, really.
I mean, social media has got to be playing a huge part.
I agree. Do you, Graham, think that it is, just a general level of unrest among especially the American populace, but maybe elsewhere in the world, too?
I think so. I think people are seeing through all the distraction and all the...
Maybe their vibrations are raising.
Yeah, they're levitating.
Don't get me going on that.
They're levitating.
Our consciousness is rising. It is.
Well, you know, maybe it is. I mean, maybe people are waking up. Maybe people are just becoming generally more well aware of what's going on in the world around them. You know, I'd like to say that that's the case, but it's been evidenced over the last few days, at least in my realm. I've found a lot of evidence of people not taking time to read news stories and to read anything and to understand to the fullest extent. I don't know about you guys, but I'm assuming that being hosts of a podcast like me, that you guys are probably news hounds. I mean, I bet you read a lot, right?
Yeah, I get 90% of my news these days from my Twitter feed.
That's really changing the playing field, isn't it?
Twitter. Yeah, it's like up to the minute, and you get, depending on who you follow, you can kind of decide whose point of views you want. You got to make sure you get a little bit of everything.
Mm. And I have to say, I get mine mostly from podcasts. I don't have a TV. I don't watch cable, so all my stuff is online or via podcast. So I kind of have a hard time following the mainstream news.
Yeah, Graham, you and I talked about that at the International UFO Congress in February. I'm very much the same. I don't, you know, we're probably going to break down, and the guys here, the boys in the bunker, we're probably going to end up having to put a television in just so we can have access to news when we're going live. We're doing 2 shows a week now, you know, and so it always helps to have late breaking news. But the thing is that, you know, in terms of my choice, my preferences, I don't ever really enjoy what I see on television. I love films. You know, I really enjoy films. But yeah, the news and the mainstream, it's just not been worth my time to have a television and to have cable piped into my home in years. And I certainly haven't had it in the bunker either. But, you know, maybe I'll have it in the bunker and just I'll keep my house free from the airwaves, you know.
Yeah, that's hard. If I had it, I'd have it on and then I wouldn't be able to turn it off. That's kind of the way I roll.
Well, you know, I have to say that, you know, and I bet you and Darren will agree. I feel like to an extent that that's what the ubiquitous in air quotes, want, is they want people to be, as Tyler would call them, slaves. You know, they don't want people to think. They want people just to tune in, zone out, and follow.
Yeah, I agree. And now they've kind of ruined the conspiracy term, right? Going back to that, like now that has real heavy negative connotations. Well, speaking of that, we have Richard Serrett from the Conspiracy Show on in a couple weeks.
Oh wow! You know, I guess you met Richard there in Arizona as well, did you not?
Yeah.
Yeah, I ran into him. He came up and introduced himself, and it was really cool to meet Richard. Like Richard a lot, and I've been a guest on his program, so you'll do very well with him, no doubt. He's a good guy. But, you know, I again, coming back to something that I think is probably mutually fueled by us all here, I can't help but look at the way that the media plays up these conspiracy theories. In this story today, marathon bombing suspect met conspiracy theorist. Or the other one that I think that initially Wall Street Journal had carried, Tamerlan Tsarnaev was into conspiracy theories, you know, and they try and make this indirect connection between people who follow conspiracy theories and people who become a danger to society. In other words, if you follow conspiracy theories, I take that to mean you are believed to be dangerous or a potentially dangerous person. Do you, I mean, am I the only person who perceives it like that?
No, well, it's the same old propaganda.
Yeah.
Always got to try and change people's minds or, you know, try and get us to go down the friggin' path, you know, that they want us to go down, and no private thinking. And, you know, that's the way that especially the U.S. seems to want to even turn the internet nowadays.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing is that, you know, again, it's like as soon as people start saying, wow, I don't know if I believe this. I don't know if I can trust my elected officials. I don't know if I can trust my media sources and my agencies. I don't know if I can trust what I read in the newspaper or online every day. Then what happens? Then all of a sudden, and by the way, people who follow conspiracy theories are people like these Tsarnaev brothers. You know, I mean, it's very interesting that, yeah, we can turn the table on the conspiracy theory by saying that if you follow conspiracy theories, maybe you're a person of interest. You know, I mean, think how many people, and part of it, yeah, I admit, part of this is entertaining. I find conspiracy theories entertaining. That's why we're going to be talking about NJ-12 during hour two. But I think that the other end of that equation is that, yes, conspiracy theories sometimes are valid and legitimate. I've never believed, based on what the evidence seems to entail, that John F. Kennedy was shot by a lone gunman. You know, I've never been able to swallow that one. And I hear, by the way, that Jesse Ventura now has a new book coming out that talks about something like, I think it's called like 60 Reasons Why JFK was a conspiracy, something like that. You guys should get Jesse Ventura on your show.
Yeah, I actually shot him an email, but it was when we were still pretty young and people weren't taking us too seriously. Now it seems a little easier to start getting guests now that we've got the engine rolling.
Oh, yeah. You know, once you have something to show for it, and you've got, you know, people like Red Pill Junkie and, you know, and, oh, gosh, who all else? Well, you know.
The Hanks Brothers.
Well, I was just talking about people who say that your show is great. But, yes, having been on the program, I know for a fact it's good. Adam Curry, of course, has also given the show a hefty endorsement. So I think that has to say something as well. But you should go for it. You know, who knows, maybe you'll end up running into old Jesse Ventura at some point on down the road. I mean, I'd hazard a guess where or when, but you never know. I mean, stranger things have happened in these sorts of circles, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly. Things seem to come together sometimes. I could see that one turning into a bit of a debate.
A debate or a debacle, maybe.
He's gonna choke slam you.
Yes, he would choke slam you. Well, you know, last I heard, he lost when it came to his confrontation with Chris Kyle. Do you remember the story about that?
No, I don't think I've heard that one.
Chris Kyle.
That's a conspiracy.
Oh, he was that sniper or whatever, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the sniper. Yeah, Chris Kyle. He had, American Sniper, I think. Maybe it was the book that he'd written. Anyway, of course, he was killed at a shooting range. I think it was just a few months ago. But he had run into Jesse Ventura at, I think it was a Navy party, basically. You know, that was a memorial service, you know, for a couple of Chris Kyle's fallen brothers, you know, there in the service. And Jesse Ventura had shown up and allegedly said something along the lines of, yeah, we could stand to lose a couple more of our guys, I think. And Chris Kyle decked him, and he was asked, well, what happened when you hit Jesse Ventura? He says he fell on the ground, and they said, what did you do? I ran.
Yeah.
How does nobody hit Alex Jones?
I don't know. I think
they
Alex
do, and it just bounces off.
I'll tell you, actually, I know the reason why Alex Jones never gets hit. Okay, I've actually thought about this quite a bit, and here's the reason why. Because he hides. Okay, Exhibit A, check it out.
I was at Barton Springs under a tree with a towel over my head because I didn't want to be, you know, in the sun.
You see, he hides. He puts a towel over his head at Springs.
He's like a monkey in a piñata, hiding in the candy.
Yet another connection of Muslim extremists and Alex Jones conspiracy theories.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, the towel over his head. Come on, you know? I mean, seriously.
We know the truth.
You guys should get Alex Jones on the show. See, I'm just pitching all the guests at you tonight.
You helped us get started. We really appreciate your help and support.
Well, it's my pleasure, truly. I mean, it's really, really, really great work that you guys, you know, do. Now, of course, I would do you no good service here if, before I let you go, if I didn't ask you to tell my listenership where they can find out more about Grimerica Podcast, so they can follow you online and where they can find you on social media.
They can find us on Facebook. We're just Grimerica, I guess. I'm not real good at Facebook. I think we've only got like 18 fans or something because I don't really know how to work it.
Oh, let me interrupt you right there. People, find Grimerica on Facebook.
Oh.
If you follow them, they will, well, they'll do something. They'll start looking at their Facebook, but follow them on Facebook. Okay, pick up there. Go ahead.
We'll get Graham to do something crazy if we get to 500 or something.
So, you know, we always love it when Graham does crazy things.
An interpretive dance of the last podcast.
And, of course, we're on Twitter @Grimerica. The website is grimerica.ca. And you can email us feedback@grimerica.ca.
And the podcast is available, I presume, at grimerica.ca.
Yeah, and or you can go grimerica.ca/iTunes and get us on iTunes that way. And it's always great if people leave a review, too.
Yeah, most of the podcast providers carry us.
Excellent. That's fantastic. You can find them all over the web. You'll hear fantastic guests, the likes of Red Pill Junkie, Dennis McKenna, Richard Serrett before long. And, of course, if you go through the archives, well, Caleb and I have been on there just as well. It's a fantastic program, Grimerica. Guys, you know, I tell you, it's been my pleasure to have you on the Grayling Report. And I hope maybe from time to time I can get you guys to come on live over the airwaves and, you know, give us news updates and things about what's going on up there at the Igloo.
You bet.
Yeah, no problem at all.
We would love to do that. Well, in fact, we'll have to make it a more frequent occurrence. Those are the boys from the Igloo. Gentlemen, I bid you adieu and cosmic love from down here in the deep south to you both, okay?
Thanks, guys. To yourself as well. Later, boys.
Thanks, guys.
See ya, dudes.
Yes.
Take it easy.
Our friends at Grimerica, fantastic fellas. Definitely check them out online and learn more about what they do. And that's going to wrap up the first hour of this week's edition of the Grayling Report. Gosh, you know the time. There it goes, flying by again. It's almost unsettling. But when we come back from this break, we're going to be looking at myths and conspiracies surrounding, yes, that ever strange and, well, unsettling story that some call MJ-12. Is it myth? Is it conspiracy? Hoax or history? Who knows? But we're going to look at all the elements and try and find out where the chips may land. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grayling Report. We'll be back right after this with Caleb and Tyler and myself. Stay tuned.
In 2013, mysteries of the past will reshape our future. Paradigm Symposium 2013 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, October 17th. Speakers will include Scott Walter of History Channel's America Unearthed, Egyptologist Robert Bavall, Dr. Robert Schock, and many more. Tickets are available online at ParadigmSymposium.com. Mankind's greatest mysteries brought to the present with new understanding. Visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
Theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grayling Report. A quick shout out to Red Pill Junkie, Reptile, Cosmos, Grimerica, of course, Justin, Mystery, Ninja, Milton, and all the fantastic folks out there. Even the Calligraphy 1019. These aren't just majestic code names, these are actually monikers being used in the chat room tonight. If I missed anyone, cosmic love to you especially. And all of those of you out there in Gradio Land, thank you for tuning in each week to hear us here on the Grayling Report. You can also hear us Sunday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern at kgraradio.com, or if you visit micahhanks.com, there's a link that'll launch the player right there from the website. Check out some of the articles, including, for those of you who haven't heard, Pittman's first article for micahhanks.com on the connection between anti-malarial drugs being used at Guantanamo Bay and MKUltra mind control. You know, a skeptic who I met at Paradigm Symposium last year, Bob Blaskowitz, had tweeted that there was an alternative theory as to what Tyler's article entailed, and that was, well, he didn't actually do the research himself. He linked to an article that Brian Dunning had written from Skeptoid Podcast talking about how MKUltra does not prove that all other instances of alleged mind control are still being carried out by government, essentially. In other words, just because MKUltra existed, we cannot assert that there is a conspiracy and that mind control technologies are still in use. But again, I think that the point that Tyler was using was that as truthout.org had speculated, as ABC News had written about. And of course, as Tyler had looked at, I think, in a very probing and rational manner, is there historical precedent for the use of antimalarial agents?
Tyler, you're good at probing.
Well, tell me about it.
I'll tell you this. Again, people would never want to believe, and maybe, sure, maybe in, from the more skeptical realm, it's right to assert that it is unlikely that this kind of technology is being used against the populace today in covert ways along the lines of what happened back in the days of MKUltra, where people's actual, you know, it was unconstitutional infringement of people's rights and right to exist. I mean, there were deaths that occurred. And what I love is that, I mean, this is all well known, and yet we have skeptics the likes of Brian Dunning's writing. He was dead wrong about a few of the facts that he tried to put in his article about Brown Mountain. Like, for instance, he's something along the lines of further off in the distance from the top of Wiseman's View or from Table Rock that you could see like the lights of Winston-Salem. That's absolutely impossible. You'd be lucky with a high-powered telescope to be able to see Charlotte, but you actually can see the Charlotte City skyrise or the bigger skyscrapers on the horizon, but you have to have, I don't think that with the naked eye, with the smog that's typically present up there, that you can see all that. So the point is that, sorry folks, yes, even sometimes the skeptics get their points a little off. But otherwise, Brian Dunning to be a very knowledgeable guy, very good writer. I really enjoy his articles. This coming from a guy who is primarily skeptical in his researches just as well. But again, I find it interesting that something that is known to have happened and that the CIA had directly involved themselves with, and that there were even documents. A lot of them were destroyed, but, you know, of course, the few that did get out were bad enough. We read a few of those on the Micah Hanks program just a few weeks ago. We're talking about, you know, everything from utilizing truth drugs to try and, you know, basically wring the truth and to wring information from an individual against their will. We're talking about sexual assaults and all different kinds of things, hypnotic, post-hypnotic suggestions and things that were made in order to activate a Manchurian candidate-style thing. I love that the CIA can release documents about this kind of technology being utilized in the 1950s and how hazardous it was to the health of those involved at the time, and that there are certain skeptics out there that will say, well, that may have happened, but we can't use that as precedent for whether it would continue. I'm not telling you that it did continue. I'm not going to tell you that it's still happening, but we know that there's historical precedent for it. And watch them take exactly what I'm saying and completely misconstrue this, and some little skeptic twerp is going to write this about this on his blog tomorrow. But the point is that I think that, again, when there's historical precedent for something, and then, as Tyler pointed out in the article at MicahHanks.com, anti-malarial agents that had been used in similar programs in the past are all of a sudden being stockpiled at Guantanamo Bay. This is, of course, off the U.S. mainland, is a prison detainee camp where even the suspected 9/11 terrorists, you know, some of them, or so, at least I think the mastermind, obviously the people who had flown the planes were killed, but then again, the conspiracy theorists on the other end of the other extreme would try and tell you that there were no planes and that planes didn't take down the Twin Towers. Anyway, you can begin to see, once you see how absurd the argument gets to be on both, I'm, again, primarily skeptical, but some people are so skeptical, and I don't know that Brian Dunning is. Brian Dunning is, I think, a fairly good researcher, but there are some skeptics out there that go so far off to the other extreme that they become what Sharon Hill of Doubtful News calls denialists. And Sharon, I have to tell you, you know, if you haven't yet gone to Doubtful News and read her Media Guide to Skepticism, take a look at what Sharon has written, where she puts it all out there and says, look, there are different levels of skepticism. Some of them are not really conducive to good research. A denialist is a person who, even when you present them with evidence, they're going to deny it and say, well, no, and based primarily on their own ideological perspectives, their own worldview, which is just as faith-based, I would say, as religion. I've seen people sit there. I remember at the International UFO Congress, you know, I was standing there having a very interesting conversation with Robert Schaefer and with Mark D'Antonio, who's been a guest on this program. And Mark began to try and explain a new physics project that NASA's working on. And Robert Schaefer stood there and basically tried to debunk it right there in front of us. And I was standing back listening to Mark D'Antonio talking about this and listening to Schaefer explain why physically he didn't think that it could be possible. And I'm just standing back looking and thinking, I wonder if, for instance, if Michio Kaku were standing there talking to Schaefer, if he would still try and debunk him. But knowing that Mark D'Antonio, being at a UFO Congress, is a person interested in UFOs, does that influence his decision to try and create a counter-argument against what D'Antonio was talking about? So I see that there's this largely ideological kind of thing that goes back and forth, and it's largely ideological hubris between the two camps that keeps us from getting anywhere, okay? In the middle, somewhere. I firmly believe and always have believed that there is the truth. And yes, Tyler, I think you put out a reasonable question with that article. Is there historical precedent for the use of anti-malarial drugs as quote-unquote truth drug agents? And should that be looked at when these, of course, sorts of drugs start showing up at Guantanamo?
Well, I think so. A point to make is just because you approach things skeptically doesn't mean you're not subject to bouts of extreme naivety, you know?
Oh, sure.
Really what this article was kind of commenting on was in a day and age where basically you can't look anywhere without pharmaceutical ads, you know, pasted like Facebook, like posts everywhere. And so
we're bombarded with it.
So to just kind of understand that and then dismiss it and say, well, you know, I'm not making a claim that it's used as a mind control agent. I'm making a claim that it was used in order to abuse someone against their rights and unethically so.
Yeah, absolutely. And see, the thing is that, of course, there's a direct tie with MK Ultra there in terms of the historical precedent. But, you know, again, as soon as you use the word MK Ultra, that's the other thing too about this that's ideological. I don't think that a lot of people out there in the blogosphere read what a person has to say. They just see MK Ultra in the headline and then they immediately react. And again, that's kind of what happened with you. I noticed when we put the article up, there were people who were tweeting, or maybe this is an excuse. And I was like, I posted the thing 13 seconds ago. You couldn't have read his article. You have no idea what he's talking about. And you're already trying to debunk him. Shut up, read the article, and then meet me back here in 15 minutes, okay?
Wow!
Oh, I love it. Ninja in the... Oh, I'm sorry. No. Reptile in the chat room said, skepticism is a good thing. Denial, well, it's a river in Egypt.
And today, what are the headlines, you know? NSA, DEA snooping on phone records to try to make drug cases. I mean, this stuff's going on. You can choose to ignore it, but it's not going to empower you in any way.
Well, again, you know, I know that someone like Sharon Hill wouldn't go to such an absurd extreme to try and deny those kinds of things. And she's the very one who, in her media guide, you know, again, she is my definition of a good skeptic. Now, does that mean that she and I agree on all points? No. Does that mean that she and I fairly frequently share ideas with one another, even if we agree or disagree on certain points? We do try and stay in touch, and we do try and share ideas and even help each other network with our different blogs and things like that from time to time, because I respect her as a researcher. But you know what? This is what's beautiful about what we do, guys. You don't have to agree with someone 150% to be able to support their ability to exercise freedom of speech and also intellectual liberties in terms of going out there and trying to find the truth. And unfortunately, I think that I'd like to, at least in a pragmatic sense, say that there is one fundamental universal truth. Maybe that's cosmic love. Who knows? But unfortunately, my truth, and this is the real world, my truth is at times, for various reasons, going to be different from Tyler's truth or Caleb's truth or Sharon Hill's truth or Red Pill Junkie's truth or Scotty Roberts' truth. You know, truth, unfortunately, at times can be subjective. Now, I'm not saying that scientific laws are something that are subjective or that the facts are something that are subjective, but I think that indeed what people take from those things can become very subjective, and this is what leads to a lot of the argument and the infighting within researchers in the community, because people are, and this is the funny thing, get away from just the believer versus the skeptic thing. We're about to delve into this discussion about Majestic 12. This, since 1987, when the Majestic 12 documents appeared on the scene, this has been a contentious issue that people in the UFO community, okay, all of them, I'm not saying every UFO researcher is a proponent of maybe the existence of UFOs or, you know, let alone aliens or anything like that. But I would say that I think all UFO researchers have a common goal. Again, they want to try and find the truth in relation to reports of unidentified flying objects. But there was so much infighting almost from the outset with Majestic 12 because there have been so many possibilities. And so, again, I think sociologically, culturally, historically, we learn a lot from studying the what do we know, how do we know what we know. It's almost like a epistemological kind of a thing. Now, back in 1987, here's the general story for those who aren't entirely up to speed on this. There were several top secret intelligence memos that were released. Some believe that they were fraudulent and that they were hoaxes, they were bogus. I tend to think that myself. Others have looked at them maybe as evidence of something that the United States military had been involved with, dating all the way back to just after the Second World War. Maybe this had something to do with the alleged crash at Roswell, New Mexico. Maybe this had something to do with reports of flying saucers that began to appear after the war. But basically, The story goes that, according to these documents, in July of 1947, a secret group that became known as Majestic 12, or sometimes abbreviated MJ-12, had been formed to essentially work on hiding the fact that Earth was maybe being visited by extraterrestrials, and that actual flying saucers seen in the skies were indeed evidence of visitation from other worlds. That was at least the premise, and that was what we took Majestic 12 to be, based on these documents. Now, they were released in 1987 to William Moore. He was a UFO researcher. They were leaked, I guess, more appropriately. Now, one of the memos, dated September 24th, 1947, was allegedly from President Truman to Defense Secretary James Forrestal. This authorized the creation of Majestic 12. There was a second that had been dated November 18th, 1952. This one was essentially a briefing document, and the briefing had been to President-elect Eisenhower from a Rear Admiral R.H. Hillenkoetter, and he had been at the time the director of the CIA, which at the time I'm not so sure that they were even called the CIA, but anyway. And of course, this briefing apparently listed the members of Majestic 12. The third document, dated July 13th, 1953, had been from a special assistant to the president. This was Robert Cutler, and this so-called Cutler Memorandum was addressed to the United States Air Force Chief of Staff General Nathan Twining. Now, there are basically three theories about what these documents, there were more than just those three, but those are some of the key documents to keep in mind while we're discussing this. And there were generally three basic premises that were put forth by the researchers in the community as to what these things are. Some people thought that William Moore, the guy who had actually released the documents, could have made them up himself. Some folks looked at them as actual proof of this Majestic 12 organization. And he claimed that the documents were fakes intended, or rather that this would have been a view held by ufologists, that these documents might have been fakes, and that maybe the fake documents had even been released. And here's what's interesting, because from the outset there were conspiracy theories that the idea had been to release fake documents to flush out the actual members of MJ-12. In other words, if we put these phony documents out specifically saying that the MJ-12 members had been involved in hiding UFO mention or information from the public, then maybe the real members will come forward and we can trick them into revealing who they were and what MJ-12 had actually been about. And then there was a third theory that basically was that essentially everything that the MJ-12 documents purported to tell had actually been genuine, and that what they were talking about wasn't just, you know, a bunch of gobbledygook, that there was actually something to it. Now, there have been a lot of people who have been alleged to be members of MJ-12 from the outset. Some of those were Adam Roscoe, Hillenkoetter, who we mentioned a moment ago, Dr. Vannevar Bush, who had apparently been the leader of the organization from the outset. We also mentioned Secretary James Forrestal, General Nathan F. Twining as well, and General Hoyt Vandenberg, Detlev Bronk, Jerome Hunsaker, Sidney Sowers, Gordon Gray, Dr. Donald Menzel, General Robert M. Monahue, Dr. Lloyd V. Berkner, and then also General Walter B. Smith, who was also alleged to be a member. Now, what's interesting is that, as we're going to find out a little bit later on, Walter B. Smith does play back into this mystery, and his potential involvement may surprise you. But before we, well, actually, you know what, we're up on a break. So when we come back from this break, we're going to go not to the horse's mouth in terms of those who might have actually been involved, but at very least, the best we can do for tonight is, at the time of the release, there were a lot of UFO researchers that were directly involved with the information that was being presented by the Majestic 12 documents. We're going to talk with a ufologist who was there the weekend that the news broke. I want to get his feelings about this and pick up the MJ-12 story when we return here on the Grailian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be back with you right after this.
Oh.
According to the Maya, the rain god Chalk created the vast oceans as he struck the clouds with his axe in ancient times. Some believe today that there may be more to these myths of strange beings, but no modern adventure will explore mysteries of our ancient past like the Ancient Alien Cruise, January 9th through the 13th, 2014. Set sail for a high seas adventure with experts in ancient mysteries and ancient astronaut theories, including author David Hatcher Childress, Dr. Robert Schock, and Hugh Newman. Go where mysteries of the ancients await you, along with a privately led shore excursion to Mayan ruins, and a one-of-a-kind fine dining experience with your guides and speakers aboard one of the specialty restaurants on deck. Sign up early to ensure the speaker of your choice, and reservations made by September 1st will receive $25 per cabin onboard credit. The Ancient Alien Cruise will depart from Fort Lauderdale. Airfare, travel, and insurance is not included, but call for additional pricing and amenities. For details, visit ancientaliencruise.com or call Holiday Maker Travel toll-free at 877-642-4308. Embrace the spirit of adventure. ancientaliencruise.com.
Welcome back to the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. You've locked into another week in the weird, and I'm glad to be your host, your guide, trying to discern right and reason from the madness that we are bombarded with on a daily basis. And the madness we're discussing tonight takes us all the way back to the year 1987, when one William Moore was leaked a series of alleged government documents pertaining to a secretive group known as Majestic 12. I've never really bought the story. In fact, I'll go ahead and tell you straight up, I don't buy it now. But I think that, kind of like when you hear the old adage, there's a little truth to every lie. Well, I think that Majestic 12 is one of those stories. I think that every time you come across something that is so bizarre in the UFO community, well, I don't know, there might be certain exceptions. But this is one of those stories where I think that there's maybe a grain of truth. Now, when we left off last segment, we'd given a brief overview, and I want to talk about a UFO researcher. He's been a guest on the program and a good friend of mine, Peter Robbins, who had actually been there the weekend that the MJ-12 controversy first essentially broke. And so I caught up with Peter recently and decided to ask him, what was it all like? What was going on? And what are your feelings about MJ-12? And this is what Peter Robbins shared with us.
It all broke open for those of us in ufology the summer, and for a few of us in the spring of 1987. In any case, as you may know, the original 8-page Eisenhower briefing document in film negative form or microfiche, whatever it was, along with the, I think it's September 28th cover letter, give or take a few days, from Truman to Forrestal, to the effect of, you are admonished to go forward with this project, blah, 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 arrived in the mailboxes of William Moore, in his own right, a wonderfully controversial, mercurial character in ufology, who co-wrote the very first book on Roswell, along with Charles Berlitz, the head of the very famous language school. A lesser-known investigator named Jamie Chanderay and our very own Stanton Friedman. They got it, I don't know, a year or so beforehand, and did their best to authenticate it. I received a copy in confidence that spring of 87, and the whole thing busted wide open in late June. In fact, at the 40th anniversary of Roswell and Kenneth Arnold MUFON Symposium in 1987 at American University in Washington, D.C. I have to say, as a brief aside, that was one of the most compelling and influential events in my life as a young, up-and-coming UFO investigator, researcher, writer who went there with a very special friend who comes from such a well-known American family that I had to introduce her under a pseudonym all weekend. That's a whole nother story. I met Senator Claiborne Pell that weekend, who was in the audience. I heard some of the best presentations thus far of my life at that point. The MJ-12 controversy blew up full scale that weekend, and it was incredibly exciting to be there at the outset. One of the things that intrigued me most, that I think it was Stan who brought home the best, was if such a thing existed. His initial investigation suggested that these 12/13 people, based on Forrestal's allegedly taking his own life in May of 1949 and then being replaced by MJ-13, would indeed have been as likely a group of individuals as Friedman and some of the better people in the initial stages of the investigation would have suggested to President Truman that he pull together. He then went on to take it a step further. And what he did was he actually did an investigation. Did these guys know each other? Would they have interfaced, certainly in their public positions and socially? And overwhelmingly, that was the case. And I returned home back to New York that weekend just obsessed with MJ-12. And within a week or so, I had sat down with my mom and dad over dinner or something, and was just a chatterbox about how interesting the weekend had been and this paper, and I had my copies, very proud of my 9 pages there to show them for the first time. Really was hoping that it was real, but understood that, you know, this could be brilliant disinformation, and I think it is both. I think it is both. And I went over it with my mom and dad. My dad was interested. My mom was more interested. And when I showed her the names of the original people, and I said, you know, this really inspired me. I met a guy who's a military witness to that English case that I told you about. Oh, God, how prophetic. And he's, you know, coming over the house this weekend. And or maybe, I have to take that back, maybe it was a week and a half later, and we had already made the agreement to do the book, and I was excited about that. I know they met Larry shortly after. In any case, now, as far as MJ-12 goes, I have come to feel over the years, and I've done my own share of research, I've meditated on it, I've looked at the other options of a brilliantly generated piece of disinformation put together on the right typewriter at the right moment, I think in November 52, as a briefing document to Eisenhower, choosing these names, syntaxes, misspellings, little bits and pieces of the way the English language functioned in 1952, flashing back to 1947. For example, simple thing. When I was pulling together my major research project on the origins of the ridicule factor and focused in on something that took me on and off, very on and off, 20 years to complete, which was pulling together every single thing the New York Times has ever published on UFOs, aerial phenomena, unidentified disks, etc., I found out two interesting little subtext footnotes to the English language in the United States in 1947. The words extraterrestrial and spaceship did not exist. And it threw me until I tried something, and this was all analog. I'm working in these big Dickensian, you know, pebble-covered, cross-referenced tomes. We're cross-referencing every subject in the New York Times, and you get the code letters, and then you go to the microfiche, and you find the right rolls of footage. You come to the article, you put in your quarter, you print out a copy. It's the closest thing for me to Las Vegas. I love it. And, of course, that era is gone, and I finished it up digitally. But what I learned was the word, the usage was extra terrestrial, not even with a hyphen, and space ship. Maybe it existed in science fiction, but it didn't in the New York Times. It did within the next few years, and everything changed. And so the other thing that was terribly exciting to me was this cover letter. The Eisenhower briefing document is 8 pages, and you know what? I think it's real. And the fact that in the Cutler Memorandum from 1952 that Stanton Friedman found in the archives, I've heard people say, well, that was planted there for him to find. And I'm thinking to myself, a cubic foot of documents is like 2,300 pages or so, depending on whether it was onion skin paper or, you know, pulp paper or whatever. I'm sorry, I have to reject that premise on a certain level. It's just, yeah, I mean, it's really deep thinking and very anticipate everything, and we want to really plant this in the mind of the ufological research community so they can argue over it, call each other names, you know, and spin their own wheels and take their attention away from more important things. This is cool. The Cutler memo specifies that there was a special project called MJ-12, but does not specify his reason. And I think Alexander and others of that ilk go with that argument. I just see too many connections between these incredibly interesting, incredibly powerful, and incredibly influential individuals, not just in that moment in time, but who they went on to become. The next thing for me, and maybe I gave this more consideration than most people, is that cover letter, that ninth page, which is a paragraph, a very terse paragraph, from Truman to Forrestal. And I know not only exactly where it lies on Forrestal's day-to-day timeline in September of 47, and I may be wrong here, I think it's on the day that he was sworn in as the first Secretary of Defense, or within a day or so of it. It also exists as a very interesting coda on the timeline of Truman's day-to-day White House schedule. It refers to a meeting between Truman and Bush and Forrestal that is noted in the White House calendar for that day, but very uncharacteristically, the reason for the meeting is not noted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Ryan Wood, being a very dear friend and a very close colleague, when he and his dad got into the business of MJ-12 and Timothy, what's his name, their basic contact who was responsible, is responsible for so much of the MJ-12, alleged MJ-12 data which followed, that is another point. I think a great deal of that is brilliant disinformation. Although, if somebody said we've proved it's all authentic, I wouldn't lose a moment's sleep. Or we've proved it's all disinformation, except for that briefing document and three other pages, I also wouldn't lose a moment's sleep. I have come to feel that either MJ-12 was an absolute reality, and that in order to cover up the incredible leaking of the Eisenhower briefing document and the Forrestal letter, that they had that material in part ready to go, or an amazing team of people. I mean, I look at the correspondence that came in, and this stuff is so tantalizing. This stuff from, Schweitzer, not Albert Schweitzer, Albert Einstein.
Right.
From individuals involved on the Manhattan Project. And these are individuals who were so famous, and we have examples of their writing and the way they use the English language and certain syntax, minuscule details that either they wrote it or it's such a brilliant understanding of the subtleties. when I refer to MJ-12 and my feelings about it, I am super careful in parsing. I am on the record as saying I really feel there is validity to these original 8 pages and to that Forrestal letter, and then I can back up the Forrestal letter for 6 ways from Sunday. I think, again, that so much of that material is so open to question. Its source is so open to question. And I think the Woods, who are probably the greatest father and son team in the history of ufology, I like them both tremendously. I consider them both friends and esteemed colleagues. I've spent time with them socially. And I know they are sincere. I think they are both extremely sincere. I don't think they're in any way plants or disinformation guys. I think they both have a lot of guts. I adore their families. I've spent time with both of their families, etc. And I think they sincerely believe that it is all real or almost all real. And you know what? I hope in their lifetimes or one of their lifetimes, they're able to prove it to the rest of us. I also feel that if I'm wrong, and the Eisenhower document, the Truman Forrestal Bush letter is, if anything, even more brilliantly generated disinformation, then there was something like MJ-12. And that's my basic overview of it. But I do have to say, and I've taken it on the chin a number of times from more conservative colleagues, I think those initial 8 pages are real. And the Eisenhower letter, the Truman letter of September of 1947, for me, I mean, I've really gone into the nuances of that. I've spent dozens of hours just contemplating that letter, researching aspects of it, dovetailing it with my considerable knowledge of the nuances of Forrestal's day-to-day schedule in that period of time. And, you know, I'm as convinced as I can be that part is real, that MJ-12 was real, that the Cutler letter or letters about MJ-12 from 52 or so are real. But I'm very circumspect about all this other stuff. I want it to be real, and I think so much of it is brilliant. And in fact, the Woods have a few pages that aren't scans. It's original onion skin, typewritten, real stuff. And the dating on it correlates just right. The ink, the typewriter face, the stationery, the paper itself, etc. So there you have the somewhat rambling answer to your fairly short question.
And that was Peter Robbins, who took some time with us to talk about his feelings about MJ-12. Now, another researcher that comes to mind, though, in relation to this is Robert Hastings. He's the author of the book UFOs and Nukes, and he's been among the researchers who had worked to determine the legitimacy of the MJ-12 documents. Now, Robert has a slightly different feeling about the entire matter than we do. This is an excerpt of audio from Robert's recent appearance on the Paracast program, and here's what he had to say about MJ-12.
Stan Friedman has done excellent work in the field of ufology. Unfortunately, he's one of those people who has been duped, in my view, by the perpetrators of the MJ-12 hoax. He's never going to admit that. I talked to him at length one-on-one at a conference in Brazil in 2009, and he may have a different memory of it, but my memory was he conceded to me personally that there's really no credible evidence or there's no verifiable way of documenting any of these so-called MJ-12 papers. He can advance, others can advance arguments for their legitimacy, but they all can be explained away with alternate scenarios that point toward a disinformational scheme or just an outright hoax. So I don't think that he'll ever have that conversation publicly. He won't acknowledge that, which is his prerogative. Kevin Randall, you know, is one of the chief people who helped debunk MJ-12 in the article that I'm posting at my website. Again, it should be up by the time this interview airs. I mentioned Randall by name and others, Barry Greenwood, the late Bob Todd, Brad Sparks, and myself, people who found just irrefutable smoking gun evidence of the fraudulent nature of the MJ-12 papers. Again, there are people like Linda Howe, who unfortunately was the first person to widely disseminate this crap. She was so duped by Richard Doty and a man named Bob Collins, AFOSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigations at Kirtland Air Force Base. She has never come to the surface since then. She's just gone further and further down the slippery slope, believing virtually everything she's told by anyone who utters the word MJ-12 and says that he has a knowledge of it. She's just a sucker for that, and it's unfortunate.
Now, I'll tell you this. Earlier today, I invited Robert Hastings to be on this program to discuss this. He did get back with me, but unfortunately, he didn't have time to join us. However, he did tell me the following, quote, MJ-12 is disinformation. The evidence is overwhelming. I'm tired of dealing with dupes, let them believe whatever they wish. And that's all Robert had to say. Now, so for as many leads with regard to the MJ-12 drama goes, Grant Cameron has recently been one to assert that there might, in fact, be evidence of an actual group that did exist. I've found this very interesting. There have been a number of blogs that have been written about this, and of course, at the president's UFO website. He talked about this just as well. Okay. And in one of the alleged recent revelations that Grant Cameron has brought to the table, he claims that during a radio interview, no other than Colonel John Alexander, the author of UFOs, Myths, Conspiracies, and Realities, dropped a bombshell while he was talking on the program of a psychic and radio host by the name of Nancy Duterte, who has been a guest on this program in the past. This is a segment of audio. This is what Colonel Alexander actually said, which, according to Grant Cameron, may confirm the existence of MJ-12.
Speaking of MJ-12, in your book, which I did mention in the beginning, it's called UFOs, Myths, Conspiracies, and Realities, you very, logically, consistently go through all of the different areas of have people talking or been in great dispute. And one of them, obviously, is this whole MJ-12 issue. For those who don't know, a Majestic 12, it's often been used as a term interchangeably with the Illuminati, the Trilateral Commission, New World Order, and was apparently a group that was historically created, you say, it was a reaction to fears created during the Cold War.
I think that there was a group, and they were created something known as COG, or Continuity of Government, and it was to prevent nuclear decapitation of the United States. So it really was super sensitive.
Okay, and then you became involved in a group known as the Aviary, which apparently was an MJ-12 offshoot.
The Aviary is a mythical thing that Bill Moore and Jamie Shandera made up. They were interested in the topic and wanted to talk about people without using their names, so they just kind of arbitrarily assigned name, nothing official at all.
And you got named after a flightless bird?
Yeah, but I keep forgetting which one, because there were three of us that got bird names at the same time.
There were only two flightless ones, though. But it was interesting. But so, let me ask you this. Does MJ-12, as far as you know, does it exist today?
I don't think so. I had somebody whisper to me that it had existed. I didn't think it existed at all. But when I looked into it and I asked if the names were correct, and they said yes, and that should tell me what I needed to know or to be able to figure it out, and that's how we came up with this particular occupation, because most of them were into nuclear warfare. That was kind of a common thread of all the people on the list, and much more so than certainly UFOs.
I have to say, that's a pretty interesting statement right there, that Colonel John Alexander, here he is talking about Majestic 12, and he says, I didn't believe that it existed at all. but then it was whispered to me that it did, and that it had everything to do with nukes. In other words, he thinks that maybe Majestic 12 was real, but that it had nothing to do with UFOs. So is that the ultimate truth, that there was an MJ-12, but that it wasn't a UFO group? Well, when we come back from this final break, we're going to look at one final bit of audio for the very man who was claiming that this allegation that John made was proof, Grant Cameron. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay with us. Can the existence of Majestic 12 be proven? And if so, what did it have to do with UFOs, if anything? Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, probably the best podcast you'll find anywhere lower than 200 meters beneath the Earth's surface. Glad that you're joining us here as Caleb, Tyler, and I broadcast from the bunker, seeking to discern right and reason from the madness with you on a weekly basis. Bi-weekly, well, no, actually, we broadcast twice weekly from the bunker. For more on that, as a matter of fact, if you go to the Graylian Report website, there's a lot of good stuff to check out. You'll see a big banner there in the right-hand column for the Micah Hanks program. Click that. That'll take you to the main site. Listen 8 p.m. Eastern on Sunday nights. You can also see Gray Street. We've got links to that on the website. Check out. Hey, speaking of, before we go any further, Caleb, what's this week's edition of Gray Street about?
This week, RPG encounters incredible danger and tries to thwart it, but that's more so next week.
Well, we'll see more about that soon, I'm sure. You know, again, we're all waiting for the epic superhero battle between all the characters on Gray Street. It's an unfolding story that is bound to please and thrall and amaze. It does all those things for us here on a weekly basis. Caleb's fantastic handiwork. Check it out. Gray Street, which is graylianreport.com/1, right? Gray Street.
Indeed. Things are about to heat up in Season 2. Season 1's closing, coming to a close here.
It's hard to believe that we've already made it through a season of Gray Street. It seemed like just yesterday we were launching our inaugural edition of that. But coming back to the discussion of MJ-12, before the clock catches us. Now, we'd mentioned during the last segment, we heard John Alexander dropping a bombshell, according to Grant Cameron, on Nancy Duterte's program, in which he actually said that he had heard whispers that an MJ-12 had actually existed, but he felt that it had little or nothing to do with UFOs. Now, Grant Cameron, writing at the President's UFO website, which is his website, of course, being the guy who's written books about UFOs and presidents, Grant Cameron has said that while this potentially is evidence that confirms the existence of MJ-12, knowing, again, that John Alexander, this is one of the guys who the film and the book, of course, The Men Who Stare at Goats, was based on, knowing his connections with government, this does maybe appear to point to evidence of something. That much we know. And this is one of two recent revelations that Grant Cameron featured at his website, which he used to substantiate the MJ-12 mystery. But now this is what's interesting. He wrote at the website that, quote, this is Grant Cameron writing about John Alexander, as Tyler glares at me here. He wrote, the sudden disclosure was strange. And that is because the MJ-12 controversy is central to the whole government cover-up theory believed by most in the UFO community. Yet, Alexander did not talk about the MJ-12 idea in his book, which had at its basic premise asserted that there is no government group controlling the UFO or dealing with, in fact, the UFO mystery. Now, I have to say that Grant Cameron is a fantastic researcher. I met him at a secret meeting last November in Pennsylvania. Caleb and I hung out with Grant a little bit. In fact, Caleb and I on the elevator were talking with Grant and very offhandedly had said, you know, you should get him on the Graylian Report. Caleb had thrown it out there, and Grant said, yes, anytime, of course. So at some point, I'd love to get him on the program and talk with him, not just about this, but about a number of things, because as a good researcher, I respect Grant an awful lot. But now let's look back again at a direct quote from his website where he said, "Yet Alexander did not talk about the MJ-12 idea in his book." That's what he says. Now, I'm holding in my hand here, this is one of those moments where we wish we had a webcam. For those of you out there who are listening, pay close attention right now. This is the crux of the matter. I'm holding a book by John B. Alexander, PhD, called UFOs, Myths, Conspiracies, and Realities, and I'm going to open this book to Chapter 7, page 122. Chapter 7 is titled Majestic 12. And let me tell you, folks, the entire chapter talks all about MJ-12. So unfortunately, although he's an incredibly well-researched ufologist, I have to point out that Grant Cameron is wrong when he says that John Alexander didn't mention this in his book. To summarize, John Alexander in Chapter 7 of his book writes, "The MJ-12 myth eclipses all other UFO-related conspiracies and cannot be ignored if one is to engage in research in this field. As noted, the notion has even permeated the National Archives and invokes images of a super-secret cabal that seems near omniscient. While no other organization in the world could function with such nefarious efficiency, believers attribute mystical powers to these keepers of the flame. Having roots deep in the human psyche, this obvious contradiction in capabilities fails to extinguish the deeply held belief that a magical federation controls all aspects of official knowledge regarding UFOs." In other words, yes, Alexander is fairly skeptical, and no, I don't think he seems to endorse the idea that MJ-12 was a UFO cover-up group. But what's interesting is because Grant Cameron uses this allegation, okay, this bombshell, this revelation, okay, that he had mentioned on Nancy Duterte's program, where he says, yes, I'd heard whispers that an MJ-12 existed, but that it had nothing to do with UFOs. Grant Cameron uses that as evidence that MJ-12 may actually have existed. Well, what's interesting is that I looked at that, and initially I'd had to think, well, then maybe John Alexander obtained this information since writing the book. But again, right there toward the end of the chapter, he says, quote, and this is key, "There is serious doubt as to whether or not there ever was an organization known as Majestic 12 or MJ-12. That's what John Alexander says. However, he continues, "if such an entity did exist, it had nothing to do with UFOs," which to me seems to assert, again, that if it existed, it had nothing to do with UFOs, and that maybe he had come across evidence that there was something akin to an MJ-12, but that there was no UFO cover-up group. So is that the end of the story? Are we to believe that there was no MJ-12, or that if there was an MJ-12, that, as John Alexander says, it had little or nothing to do with UFOs? Well, I want, before we close this out, to fire one final bit of audio. This segment is Grant Cameron, who, again, I'm going to have to call him on this and say, Grant, you were wrong when you said that John didn't talk about it in the book, because the entire seventh chapter deals with MJ-12. Okay? But Grant Cameron also brings some very useful information. This is audio from the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure this past May, where he was in Washington, and he literally discussed the secret document that was found in not the U.S. National Archives, but in the Canadian National Archives, which seems to allude to an MJ-12 type organization, and furthermore, that Vannevar Bush had actually been in charge of that. This is Grant Cameron talking before the Citizens Hearing about that.
This is the famous top secret memo that Stanton Friedman helped force out in 1978. It was written in 1950, but it did not get declassified till 1978. It is a top secret document. The Canadian government does not deny this document. It agrees that this is a legitimate document. It was stamped top secret. It was written by Wilbert B. Smith. The background to it was the Canadians in 1950 had decided they were going to go to the Americans. They were going to find out what the Americans knew about the flying saucer program. They went down and through the military attaché at the Canadian embassy, and through the Canadian embassy, they asked questions of the Americans. Is this for real? What's going on? And here's the conclusion that went back to the Canadian government. The subject is the most highly classified subject in the United States, rated higher than the hydrogen bomb. Flying saucers exist. Their modus operandi is unknown, but there's a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, who is the science advisor to Roosevelt, that he's in charge of the program. And the fourth thing was the entire matter is considered to be of tremendous significance. And then the fifth point that he mentions, and this goes to Mr. Bartlett's question about how did they get here from 37 light years away. He said, I was further informed that mental phenomena may be associated with the flying saucers and that the Americans aren't doing very well because they've asked that if we're doing anything in Canada, they're willing to exchange credentials and talk to us about it. That's the top secret memo. Flying saucers exist. What's happened in the last 50 years has been a circus.
It's a very interesting statement there that Grant Cameron makes. And again, if this document from the Canadian National Archives, which Cameron says has actually been confirmed to be an actual document, if that is to be believed, then it seems that the Canadian government, at around the time of the formation of MJ-12, had indeed believed that there was an organization that the Americans were working on, that they did have interest in UFOs, contrary to what John Alexander says. And furthermore, that they were looking into the UFO problem, and that Vannevar Bush, and as I'd mentioned earlier, I told you that Wilbur B. Smith would come back into this. Well, there his name is mentioned again because he apparently had authored, I believe, a portion of this memo, according to Cameron there. So the point is that, again, I don't know that I could tell you that MJ-12 is real. I certainly couldn't tell you whether or not those documents that were released in 1987 were authentic or not. But what I can tell you is that if we are to believe the information presented in that document from the Canadian National Archives, at very least, maybe like John Alexander has says, there was an MJ-12. It seems to be the case that there was. To what extent they were involved with UFOs, well, we may never know. But again, Grant Cameron asserts that, and pretty strongly, that based on what that document seems to indicate, it seems that it was indeed a UFO group. Now, were they covering up UFOs? Were they slowly releasing information to the public? Were they just controlling the information without allowing it to be released to the public? Who knows? But again, as I think that we often find on a program like this, there is myth, there is conspiracy, and then there's reality. The reality may be in the minutia, but there's always a little bit that has something to do with what's actually going on out there. And so I'm going to tell you guys, as we wrap up this week's edition of the program, that whatever that truth may be, I don't profess to have full knowledge of it. I don't profess to be someone who's going to bring to you, without question, unequivocal knowledge of extraterrestrials visiting Earth. I just think that, again, there's a lot more, probably, than the people who are polarized and who put themselves over on the right and the left sides of belief and skepticism and doubt and faith and all these kinds of things. I think there's always a little more to it. It may be very little, but nonetheless, there's a little truth that kind of falls there in the center, and that's going to have to wrap it up for this week's edition of the program. My friends, on behalf of Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Dick Oakley, Matthew Oakley, John Anderson, and of course, yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, I bid you adieu for another week. Check us out 8 p.m. Eastern Time at KGRARadio.com this Sunday night at 8 p.m. It is the Micah Hanks program. And otherwise, well, you may have to wait until October to see me at Paradigm Symposium. I'm Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South. And as always, my friends, stay strange. We'll talk to you again next week.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.